Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also pleased to have back here on the program once again, Dr. Robert Bocek. He's a pediatrician, and he's on the program once a month on Thursday, and we do these shows on a regular basis to give you the opportunity to ask questions about children and their health. And we've talked about a lot of different things over the years we've been doing the show. Anything that you could imagine asking a pediatrician is fair game, and I know that the doctor will take his best shot at giving you an answer. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. So 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. It's good to be back.
I went looking for some things that maybe we could talk about. We always hope that we can get some calls and can help some people out. But looking for things we could talk about. And here's something that I thought was kind of interesting. And again, you know, I'm sure you could find a study about everything in the world. This happened to be a study that was published in a recent issue of Pediatrics. And what they were looking at was the level of physical activity that kids with asthma had. And what they found was that, and maybe not surprising, is that kids with asthma are a lot less active than their peers who don't. The catch is that apparently, according to physicians, there's actually no real reason for them not to be. And according to the study, that we know that that's obviously important for kids to have physical activity. We're seeing a lot of health problems connected with the fact that they're not, and that there is no reason for that kids with asthma can't be involved in can't run, can't swim, can't do a lot of the physical activity things. So you wonder, well, is this because they can't think that they can't do it? Is it because their parents think that they can't do it, and so they're not encouraging them? Did some doctor say, well, you got to kind of watch the physical activity? Are they getting bad advice, or is this just something that they think is the case? You have asthma, well, that means that you can't have physical activity.
Yeah, and I guess I'm not aware of this study. And did this study compare asthmatics to other children? And are we seeing a general lack of physical activity in children? That could be possibly, but again, I hope no physician is giving advice of limiting an asthmatic's physical activity. And I think that the thrust of treatment of asthma now is to normalize these kids' lives as much as possible. Some kids will have what we call exertional asthma. If they run or exercise strenuously, they will develop bronchospasm. They'll have trouble breathing. But I think with the therapeutic regimens we have out there now, we can minimize that, and our goal as physicians is to help asthmatics to enjoy life to the fullest, to be able to participate in all activities that other kids have. Now, okay, that's not always possible, but yeah, we try to maximize that. And the other thing is swimming, for some reason, even in the child with the worst exercise intolerance who can't run, can't play basketball, has trouble with soccer, those exercises that involve a lot of consistent long-distance type of running, swimming is usually a very excellent sport for them. For some reason, swimming's good exercise, it's good exertion, but for some reason, swimming doesn't tend to bother the exercise intolerant asthmatic. So, you know, yeah, again, treatment will normalize most of these kids' lives. They will be able to fully participate in soccer and track and basketball and all the sports. And if it can't be done completely, well, let's find an activity they can participate in.
Okay, very good. We have some callers here. Let's go to the phones. We have our first caller in Aurora on our toll-free line, line number 4 right here. Hello.
Yes, hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I just wanted to call in and speak to exactly what you're talking about. I have the granddaughter who now has an adopted sister, so to speak, and they're getting along fine, the two girls. They laugh all the time. which is great. They just, I can't remember 12-year-olds laughing as much as they do. They're giddy all the time, and it's great. But I asked them about 2 months ago, I would give them money if they took all the paper, scraps of paper, et cetera, that were on the lawn and on the properties. I would pay them if they'd pick it up and remove it. Well, neither one will do it. And I wonder, is there a way I can say that, or should I forget about it and do it myself? Or I just thought it would be a way for them to make a little bit of money, and I thought it was a good idea, but then I'm an adult.
You know, money doesn't tend to be a terribly good, in my experience, money doesn't tend to be a terribly good reward in kids unless they have something very special they want, a CD, a video game, something like that that they want. Otherwise, I think most of our kids have so much stuff that, you know, money's not a tremendous inducement. So I think, okay, what could be an inducer? I don't know. Will you do this for Grandma? You know,
No, I don't use that phrase.
Why not? Why not?
Well, why should I?
Well, because you're the one that wants, I presume it's your yard you're talking about?
Mine and theirs.
Okay.
But theirs is smaller.
You know, why not? You know, you've done nice things for these girls. I don't think I'd lay the guilt trip on them, but you know what?
No, I'm trying not to.
You know, Grandma's yard's a mess. Will you please, you know, would you please pick up the trash in the yard for Grandma? You know, it's just to be nice to Grandma. It's, you know, it's a personal thing.
Should I ask them why they don't want to do it?
No, I wouldn't ask them why. You know the answer. It's boring.
Oh, I forgot the old B-O-R-I-N-G word.
I mean, why would I want to do that? If the wind comes along, it's going to blow it away again anyway, or more trash is going to appear. So, you know, I don't think they don't care about their rooms. They don't care about the trash in your lawn.
Oh, but wait. Guess what? They do care about their rooms all of a sudden. Came up.
Okay, well, we'll see how long that lasts. But anyway, yeah,
And they got rid of a bird that my daughter didn't want them to have, but let them have, and they also got rid of the guinea pig.
Okay. Yeah, I think, you know, will you do this as a favor to Grandma?
Really?
I'll
try it.
I'd sure try that, because the money's not an inducement, and I think, you know, gee, it really bothers Grandma, and, you know, my knees aren't so good. It's hard for me to bend and stoop and pick it up. Actually, I wouldn't even give any reasons. I'd just say, will you do this as a favor for Grandma?
Well, you know, and I thought it would be a learning experience. Maybe they could see the daffodils coming up, the tulips coming up, and notice those kind of things. So it also was a learning experience. I also asked them if they'd fill my bird feeders, and I didn't get any takers on that either.
But, you know, doing it as a kindness to another person is a tremendous learning experience.
Well, I'll try. I'll try. But the girls are doing, they did go out and play soccer yesterday, and after I listened to what you just said about asthmatics, because both of them are, and I'm glad to hear that they did play soccer and didn't seem to have a problem with it. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Okay. Let's go on. We'll talk next with somebody on our line number one, and I believe that caller is in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hi. I wanted to ask about allergy medication. My 9-year-old son has been congested for, I don't know, as long as we can remember. He recently told a relative who asked him about it that he'd been stuffed up since kindergarten, and he's in third grade, although he doesn't sneeze or have other symptoms. Recently, we took him into the doctor for a checkup and talked about this, and she gave us some samples of Zyrtec, 10 milligrams, and also a prescription that we could get filled if it seemed to be helping. I'm just a little concerned about giving medication to a 9-year-old. I wondered if you could tell me anything about possible side effects or any information or research that's been done on the effectiveness of allergy medication. We do suspect that he has an allergy to dust. His mother's had problems with that, possibly mold, other household kind of things.
Okay. Antihistamines have been around for, I don't know, a long, long time. The adverse effects of antihistamines mainly are sleepiness. And I think that's where the newer antihistamines have come out to minimize the side effects. So, and Zyrtec, although it's not of the non-centrally acting antihistamines, does seem to have a lower incidence of lethargy and sleepiness with it. And it's also nice because it's once or twice a day, so it's kind of convenient. They don't need a dose in school and that. So it's, it generally will be relatively side effect free, and it may relieve his stuffiness. If that doesn't work, probably the next step up would be maybe nasal steroids, a nasal spray. Although kids that age tend to just, fingers seem to go in noses at that age, but medication and other applicators aren't supposed to go in noses, so those don't tend to be tolerated well. The next step after that would probably be allergy testing and desensitization shots, although that we don't recommend that much anymore because, again, we have medications that control the symptoms. But Zyrtec's a pretty good antihistamine, and it tends to be relatively side effect free. And I think your doctor's been very, very thoughtful and kind to give you some samples to see, number one, does this medication help your child? And number two, is this medication well tolerated by the child?
Okay, so you don't have any concerns about long-term? I mean, my other concern is that if it works, he's going to be taking this every day for the long-term. You don't have any concerns about long-term?
Yes and no. No, we don't know of any long-term harm done to the person by taking it. Oftentimes, if you use a medication for a long period of time, you develop a tachyphylaxis. It just ceases to work. And then you have to switch to a different antihistamine. But outside of that, no, there's no problem. And I presume, again, he's had a good physical exam, so his tonsils and adenoids aren't too large, that he is having a stuffy nose because he has a stuffy nose, not because there's something elsewhere obstructing the airway. The other thing we don't like to see is we don't like to see the frequent use of over-the-counter nasal sprays. Some of those that are out there will develop if they're used chronically, they will develop a paradoxical where the nose gets stuffier. So you have to use the medications more and more often, and the nose and the efficacy, the length of time it works gets less and less, and they develop what we call rhinitis medicamentosa, which can be a real problem because the treatment for this is to withdraw them from the nose sprays, but then they really get stuffed up, and it just, it's kind of a drug withdrawal, I guess, if you will, although it's, certainly not like withdrawing from cocaine or heroin or anything, but yeah, the nose stays quite stuffy, and it may take several weeks before the nose sprays, before this rhinitis medicamentosa resolves itself. So yeah, rather an antihistamine than frequent use of nose sprays.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Right, thank you. Other questions are welcome. Our guest this morning, Dr. Robert Bocek. He's a pediatrician and he's with us once a month, always on a Thursday, and we talk about children's health. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I think that the first non-sedating antihistamine to be available, as far as I can remember, was Claritin. And for a while, that was available only by prescription, and now that's gone over the counter. So you could just go into the drugstore and buy Claritin. Also, of course, the folks who made that, they now have a replacement prescription medication called Clarinex, which I guess is chemically probably very close but different enough so they can get a patent. And then there's Zyrtec. So there are some that are still by prescription, and there's this one that you can just go out and buy. If you're interested in trying one of these non-sedating antihistamines, is there any evidence that says that Clarinex, for example, works any better than Claritin. So, you know, you could just go and buy the stuff, or you could go to the trouble of going to your doctor and getting a they write you a ticket for it. Is the prescription any better than the over-the-counter?
Probably not. And the often the game we play with the nasal allergies is try this one, see if it works. If it doesn't work, try the next one and and just see which one works best. Zyrtec technically is not of the non-sedating antihistamine class.
Oh.
Although it is advertised as being relatively non-sedating.
Okay. So I guess also even among those that are that have that as a side effect, there apparently are some that can, you know, good old-fashioned Benadryl works great as an antihistamine, but that also has that side effect.
Yeah. But not not in everybody. It is a side effect. It's and with Benadryl and some of the older ones, the side effect was present in a substantial number. But and the Zyrtec seems to not be as much in the Claritin. Actually, Celdane, I think, was the first non-sedating one that was on the market, but that one probably didn't work very well.
Well, maybe Claritin was the first one that really seemed to work pretty well, although I think there are probably also some people who would say, oh, I took that and it didn't do anything.
It didn't do anything, And I think, again, diagnosis first, history, physical diagnosis. Am I dealing with allergic rhinitis, or am I dealing with nasal polyps, or am I dealing with enlarged adenoids, and that's why they can't breathe. They have an airway obstruction elsewhere.
Well, then that gets to the question of how do you know what it is you're trying to deal with. I guess a person could have a cold at any time. It's also possible at any time you could have an allergic reaction. You know, we know at certain times of the year, in the spring when everything's going nuts, some people have trouble. At the other end of the season, in the fall, sometimes people have trouble. And then if you are allergic to pet dander or dust mites or, you know, all that kind of stuff that could be mold in your house, that could be a problem year round. So it can be difficult sometimes unless you actually do the old-fashioned scratch test to figure out what it is that people are actually allergic to.
Often those aren't necessary. A cold should be gone in 2 weeks. Allergies seasonal allergies tend to go through the season. If it's something acute like cats, you know, I went to visit somebody's house and they had a cat and my child really loved the cat and really came home with itchy, swollen, red, watery eyes and a stuffy nose and that. And, you know, within a few hours it was gone again. So often history will tell you, give you a pretty good idea what they're allergic to. You know, this time of year as the trees start to bud, you say, trees are likely, history will tell me that your child may very well be having a reaction to the trees budding. I can't tell you whether it's maples or oaks or anything like that because they're all budding at the same time. But history will often give you a good idea of where to go. And most of the allergists will skin test. They'll do somewhat of a battery, but they'll focus on what season are you having problems, and we'll look at the things that are around that time of year.
We have some other folks to talk with, and the next caller is in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi there. Mm-hmm. Just a question. I am due in about 8 weeks, and just trying to get some advice from the doctor as far as when to start interviewing pediatricians and what should I generally look for in a pediatrician, and just some basic advice for the very beginning of baby's life.
Congratulations. I think I reminisce when our kids were little and my wife was pregnant and that, and I think you're in for a great experience and a wonderful time. I think you can start interviewing pediatricians now.
Okay.
And I think maybe one of the screens is if the pediatrician won't give prenatal interviews, maybe that's a pediatrician you don't want to see anyway. I used to do. I enjoyed the prenatal interview, and I think it's if you have a specific question. I think mostly newborn care is sort of pretty much rote and routine. It's pretty much newborn care. If you have any specific questions, if there's any specific risk factors in your history, I think.
For instance, I'm currently gestational diabetic.
Okay.
So I don't know if that they say doesn't really impact the baby sometimes?
If you're under good control, probably won't impact the baby.
Okay.
But you can, bring up any of your anxieties. If you have things that are out of the ordinary, if you want to breastfeed standing on your head or something like that, I think those are the things that you might bring up. But I think mostly what you're doing is saying, am I going to be comfortable with this person? Am I going to be comfortable welcoming this person into my family? Because I considered, as a pediatrician, being part of my patients' families in a way, if you will.
Okay.
And, am I comfortable with this person as a person? Do I want this person as a friend? Do I want this person to be part of my family? How do I reach this person after office hours? Who will I be talking to? That sort of thing. But I think mostly, do I like this person? Will I be comfortable in the office talking to this person? Will I be comfortable in the office talking to this person about things that don't relate to a runny nose, don't relate specifically to breastfeeding? I think they're talking a lot now in the medical literature about, are pediatricians observing whether mothers have postpartum depression? And the article was, mothers aren't comfortable bringing, the blues up with their pediatrician because that's not part of the role. The pediatrician's there to take care of the baby. But I'm not sure that's true, because if the mother's not doing well, the baby's not likely to be doing well either. So I think, are you comfortable discussing other things with the with the pediatrician?
Okay. And how soon after birth do pediatricians tend to like to see the baby?
Somebody will see the baby in the nursery.
Okay.
A pediatrician will see the baby in the nursery, and usually the first visit now is either with the pediatrician or nurse practitioner, depending where you live, usually on the third day.
On the third day?
On the third day postpartum. And what that's all about is mainly that's to check for jaundice, because the hospital stay has become short. It's, 24, 36 hours or so, and jaundice tends to hit on the third day. So often they like to see on the third day to make sure that nobody's missing jaundice, because jaundice can be damaging to the hearing and the brain, and we just don't want to miss it. And they're likely to go home from the hospital before jaundice is likely to appear. So often on the third day, like sort of a brief visit, just kind of a color check.
Wow. Okay. Okay, I hadn't realized it was that soon. I was thinking a month or so after.
Yeah. No, it's usually the third day. And then what I did is, if it was your first baby, I'd see you in 2 weeks.
After that, okay.
At that.
Okay.
If you were a veteran, I wouldn't see you till 6 weeks or 8 weeks or so. But the two-week visit I liked, especially with the first-time mother, because if you're breastfeeding, we expect babies to regain their birth weight by 10 days to 2 weeks. They're going to lose about 10% of their birth weight after they're born. And I presume you're going to breastfeed.
Right. That's the idea.
Yeah, and you've never done it before, so you don't know if it's working or not. baby's sucking at the breast, but, you don't know what's transferred between the breast and the baby.
Uh-huh.
So often the three-day check, we can get a feel of how the breastfeeding's going, and certainly by 2 weeks we can see if the baby's regained birth weight. And then you say, hey, if the baby's regained birth weight, things are probably going well.
Okay. Okay, great. Okay, so good. That's good advice then. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. We are at our midpoint already of this hour of focus with our guest, Dr. Robert Bocek. He's a pediatrician. We do these programs every month to give you a regular opportunity to ask questions about children's health. That's what we're up to here. If you have questions, you are certainly welcome to call. If you're in Champaign-Urbana, here where we are, 333-9455. The toll-free line, 800-222-9455. Next is someone in Charleston, line four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I've got a 13-year-old son who is ADHD, and currently he's on 80 milligrams of Adderall a day.
Okay.
My question that I have deals with the time that he's coming off of Adderall, the time from about 8 o'clock to about 7 o'clock in the morning, can be murder.
Okay.
And what I was wondering is there something that he can take? Is there something that we can do to help help him be a little more even keel? He sometimes gets combative.
Just gets out of control.
Yes.
Yeah.
Very.
Talk to your doctor. I've seen reports of kids getting a dose of a stimulant medication like Adderall or Ritalin or whatever medication they're on at bedtime.
Mm-hmm.
And, all right, why give a kid a stimulant at bedtime? Geez, I don't want this kid up all night. I want this kid to sleep. Well, these studies have shown that these kids not only sleep well, they sleep better than they did before. And, yeah, I think if he really has that much hyperactivity, yeah, he deserves to feel under control 24 hours a day if possible. And it's possible that he's on a pretty big dose of Adderall. And it's possible that a small dose at bedtime or as this starts to wear off at 8 o'clock at night may be just a real gift and may
right.
make life a whole lot more pleasant for everybody. And I think, again, when we're treating attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, we're treating the child, we're treating the family, we're treating the classroom. If we
right.
really help... Yeah, if we help these kids to come under control, the classroom teacher has a lot easier time. The family has a lot easier time. It's just nice for everybody.
Fantastic. Thanks.
Okay.
You're
Very
welcome.
Good. And again, we'll go next to Terre Haute, and this is line number two. Hello.
Hello, Dr. Brocek. I'm going to not switch topics on you because I have an ADHD question as well. I have a niece who is 6 years old, and she exhibits some symptoms of ADHD. She, for example, she doesn't stay on task. She doesn't have an attention span. However, on the flip side, she doesn't seem to be hyperactive. I mean, a lot of times when she's with me, I have to push her off the couch to go out and play. And the educators at the school had suggested that she, you know, had a problem and that she should be put on Strattera. And I was just a little bit concerned that something like Strattera just might slow her down. And she doesn't seem to be hyper now, and I would hate to give her something that just slow her down just so that she could, you know, have a more of an attention span and focus better. I mean, she's only
okay.
6 years old. She's a kindergartner.
See, I think that's, I guess, number one, I don't think a school ought to make a diagnosis and specifically recommend a treatment. I think the school, they aren't trained to do that. I think the school people should say, you know, we've got this student. These are the things we're seeing that are interfering with her social life, with her educational life, whatever. I really resent it when they offer a diagnosis. I resent it even more when they say this is the medication you're supposed to use. I don't think that's their business. And I think I'm with you also that I think the diagnosis of attention deficit disorder with or without hyperactivity, and I think what we're talking about is she'd be the one without, is very difficult. I think all diagnoses where you don't have a laboratory or an x-ray or something to hang your hat on when it's, yeah, six symptoms from column A and three symptoms from column B gives you the diagnosis is tough. I think you're absolutely right. Attention deficit disorder type, yeah, is she too young? Is that what she's manifesting? Not attention deficit disorder with hyperactivity, but she's just a six-year-old kid, and maybe she's developmentally, it tends to be more common in boys than girls, and boys are a little slower developmentally, and maybe she's just a little slower developmentally, just not quite gotten up to stride yet. Not, again, that there's anything wrong with her in the long haul, but she's just not quite ready for it yet, and I guess, how is she doing in kindergarten as far as her letters and numbers and the things she's supposed to do?
She's
What's
learning.
The school complaining about?
I think overall she's not up to par with her peers. She's just slower, and when you're around her, you would realize that she's immature
okay.
compared to her peers. But she does have the ability to learn, and she's learning. I just don't think that she's up to the level of her peers, and I think that's probably what started the
okay.
entire discussion.
You know, I think there's nothing wrong with saying, you know, this child is not failing. She's not up for retention or anything like that. We've talked with the physician. We've talked with the schools. We've talked with everybody involved. We think that probably she's just a little slower about maturing. Let's wait another year. Let's see what next year brings. Maybe she'll have caught up by then. I think there's no hurry, particularly if they're, you know, if they're doing okay, not great, doing okay. I think there's no harm in waiting another year and saying, okay, we're going to keep a good eye on this child. We're not going to let her get lost in the shuffle, and we'll just reevaluate next October. Or December or whenever. You know, I think, yeah, we aren't neglecting this child, but we just don't agree with the medication at this time, and we're just going to follow. We're going to keep a close eye on her. We're going to follow her along, and we'll intervene when we think it's appropriate.
Okay. Well, that eases my mind. I never feel like any kind of drug is a silver bullet for kids, especially when you're just 6 years old.
Yes. Yeah. And, I think there are some experts who say, you know, maybe no kid ought to start school till they're age 7. Because by then, almost all kids are going to be reading ready. The boys and the girls will have caught up with each other. I'm not sure I completely agree with that, but I'm not sure I completely agree that a child ought to be reading ready by the time they start kindergarten, because kindergarten, they're 5 years old. Okay. Many of the girls are going to be reading ready. A lot of the boys aren't. And that doesn't mean that they need to be on Ritalin or a medication. It means that, you know, the developmental clock is just ticking along, and we probably can't speed it up, and we probably can't slow it down. It's just going to tick along.
Well, thank you for your answer. You've eased my mind quite a bit.
Okay, great.
Okay. Thank you for the call. We'll talk next with someone in Chicago on our line one. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like to switch gears, since it is the season, back to allergies, and ask you to discuss when we're presented with decisions as far as steroidal and non-steroidal medications, and then inhaled versus ingested, and I'll hang up and listen if that's okay.
Oh, sure. Stay on the line a bit, please. I guess I need a further definition. You're talking about antihistamine. What do you mean by steroidal or non-steroidal?
Particular people that have breathing problems, I guess there are steroid-type medications that they can inhale or ingest.
Okay, this is for asthma.
Is it strictly for asthma?
No, there's a nasal steroid, too. Okay. Okay, I can go from here. We talked about the antihistamines. We mentioned the steroids. The nice thing about the inhaled steroids, be it for asthma or for lower respiratory symptoms or for nasal symptoms, is they're so-called, often they're so-called first-pass detoxified. They hit the liver, they're gone. They're not a steroid anymore, so they have minimal to no steroid side effects. And steroids, prednisone, boy, they're nasty. It eats holes in your stomach. It suppresses your growth. It weakens your bones. It does all kinds of bad things. But these steroids that are used in allergies are so-called first-pass detoxified. So they work on the nose. They work on the lungs where they're inhaled, but they don't tend to work very much on the rest of the body. And I may not be telling you exactly the strict truth there. If you look at the steroid adrenal or the pituitary adrenal axis, you can see some minor differences in kids who are on inhaled steroids versus kids who aren't on inhaled steroids. But it seems to have no clinical significance, except that there is some evidence that it suppresses their growth for the first very few months they're on it, less than a year they're on it, and we think that these kids achieve normal heights. We don't think that it stunts their growth in any way in the long run. These drugs have been just a godsend for people with allergies. When I was in training, asthma was reversible obstructive airway disease. Okay, the muscles in the airways spasm down, the airways got narrow, you block that. You give them something that dilates the muscles. Well, we now know that asthma is an inflammatory disease. It does have a component of muscle spasm, a bronchospasm to it. That's where the Ventolins and those, the albuterols and those kind of medications work. But most importantly, it's an inflammatory disease of the lung. And asthma untreated will lead to chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, COPD, and pulmonary hypertension and all kinds of bad stuff. And that's where the steroids come in to block the inflammatory reaction on the lungs or the nose in the case of nasal allergies. And it's a real sweet treatment. It's really a neat thing and works very well. And again, is probably very, very safe. It does have steroid side effects, but they seem to be, as I talked about before, minimum. We can measure it chemically, but we can't measure it clinically that it does anything bad to the lungs. And I guess the other thing I tell people is, okay, if this medication makes your child, and okay, Dad, you're 6 foot, and Mom, you're 5'7", so we're anticipating that this child's going to be normal for gender. Okay, with these medications, maybe we're going to make them a half inch shorter. So we're still very acceptable that way, but we're going to make this child's life much, much more pleasant. We're going to allow them to participate in school. We're going to cut their absences back down. We're going to allow them to participate in sports and activities. They're just going to be a half inch shorter. And that's probably not true, but worst case scenario, we're going to make a half inch shorter. Boy, isn't it worth it? Yes, in my opinion, I think it is.
All right. Well, I hope that helps. And the caller certainly should feel free to call back if he wants to ask any follow-ups. We have about 15 minutes left in this part of the show with pediatrician Dr. Robert Bocek. It's our monthly program on children's health. 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455 if you'd like to call. Urbana caller up next in line three. Hello.
Hi there.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is an excellent show so far.
The
question I had was more of a general one, kind of backing up to the ADHD stuff. Just wondering in general if you could kind of speak to changes in the way we kind of as a society are dealing with kids these days. I mean, it seems like everybody that I know, I don't have any kids myself at this point, but it seems like everybody that I know, you know, either has or knows a kid who's taking Ritalin or something like that to, you know, manage their child during the day. And I think, you know, back to when I was growing up and, you know, we didn't have that stuff. And I am absolutely certain that I'd have gotten it if they'd had it to give to me at the time. And, you know, I mean, things went okay for me and things turned out all right. I'm just wondering, you know, I mean, obviously there's a real clinical problem that is being addressed in certain cases. But my question is, have we gone kind of overboard with that? Or, I mean, is it just that we recognize it and are able to deal with it better? Or is this just an expectation from parents that don't have the time and the energy to keep up with their kids or what? So I guess that's my question.
Yeah, or what? I'm not sure what's going on either. You know, when I first started practice, what we'd see, it's always been boys, predominantly. A few girls straggle in, but it used to be that, you know, they'd be referred to me as 9, 10, 12-year-old boys who were doing poorly in school and had, you know, why. And, you know, they've been to the school psychologist. They don't have any learning disabilities or anything like that. And, oh, yeah, we notice these behaviors, too. Okay, maybe these kids deserve to be on stimulants. Then as I was in practice longer and longer, it was still predominantly boys, but the age went down. You know, all of a sudden, most of the referrals are 5 and 6. Occasionally, they're 3 and 4. Are we, you know, and again, as I alluded to earlier, I'm troubled by any diagnosis that I can't document with lab or X-ray. And when we're dealing with this thing of, you know, they've got 3 symptoms from column A and 6 from column B, that makes the diagnosis, that gives you the treatment. And the other question is that I always had is, how much is enough? You know, okay, this child can't sit still in class. Well, how long do you expect them to sit still in class? And what is too much intolerance of sitting still in class?
Right. I mean, the places that I got into trouble with stuff like that, I mean, looking back at when I was a kid, I mean, the places that I got into trouble with stuff like that, and the places, and it didn't happen very often. I'm a successful professional at this point.
Yeah.
But the places where I had problems getting bad grades, or doing poorly with my schoolwork was simply because I was bored out of my mind. I mean, this is like, yeah, whatever. I mean, we did this last week, and I know how to do this, and, you know, I'm not interested in this anymore. Can we do something more interesting? And, of course, the answer was no, we have to stay with the curriculum.
Yeah, now, yeah, is our educational system, does it need to be re-evaluated? Because now, now that a lot of my patients are in college or married and have children and that sort of stuff, I'm hearing, you know, boy, we had this kid on Ritalin, and we fought this school, and we did all this and that, and boy, he got out of high school, got to college. He's now working on his PhD or as a successful dentist or CPA or something like that, and we never had problems. You know, once he got to college, we never had problems again. And I'm concerned that, yes, I think we're making – I think the diagnosis is made too frequently. I think maybe our expectations are unrealistic for certain age groups. Well, I'm sitting here talking – drinking a cup of coffee. An hour ago, I was at the hospital volunteering. You know, do you sit someplace 6 hours a day without a coffee break, without a break in the schedule? And I think maybe our school day is maybe not planned for a child's development. You know, for what a child can be expected to do.
More in terms of our expectations of what we want?
Yeah. Although, again, you know, there was an article that somebody studying the behavior of kids and the amount of TV they watch, and I think I've alluded to it somewhat facetiously on this program before, that, yeah, are we, with television, are we tuning our kids' attention span to 15 minutes? And I've kind of jokingly suggested teachers, and I think on this program too, teachers are teaching wrong. They need to teach for 12 minutes, and then they need to sing a jingle for 3 minutes. They need to go to commercial break for 3 minutes. And are we diagnosing attention deficit hyperactivity more often than it appears? Are we, with mass media and that and video games and the internet and that, are we programming our children's attention span to be shorter than what it needs to be? And I think there's a lot of unanswered questions here, and I'm not sure what we're going to do about the problem.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right. Well, other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, if you want to call in. I guess I sort of feel like anytime we have discussion like this, you also have to acknowledge the fact that while there are kids who maybe are borderline, and maybe there are kids who you'd actually say, well, maybe there's really no problem at all. There are kids who do have severe problems, and there are parents who will tell you, you just come over and spend a couple hours at my house with my kid, and I'll show you. And that those parents will say, and then once we had the opportunity to use the medications, it was nothing short of a miracle.
Yes.
How much of a change that could make. So it's a really unclear kind of picture because naturally, of course, kids are they're all over the map.
Yes.
In terms of where they are, and finding some real clear lines, to say this child has a serious problem, this child has no problem, and this child is somewhere in the middle, and we're not really quite sure what the best way to address their needs is.
Yeah, and how do you measure behavior? Yeah. What's the gender of this child? What's the classroom situation like? Is this a good teacher or is this a mediocre teacher? What's the family situation like? Boy, there's an awful lot of variables in here that are really hard to control. And I absolutely agree. I've had patients who you put on a stimulant medication, and it was just a life-changing experience.
Sure.
And others, it didn't do much of anything at all. And some kids, it turned into zombies. And I think, again, the medication is to help this child. And like I said, secondarily, primarily to help the child. Secondarily, it'll help the classroom if we settle the child down. It'll help the family. It'll make the family life more pleasant. But the primary goal is to help the child. And, I've seen some kids that it just turned them into zombies, just automatons. They were quiet. They sat still. They didn't interrupt the class. I'm not sure they did anything. They just sat in their chair. And that's unsatisfactory use of medication. That's not what it's supposed to do.
Let's talk with another caller in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hello. I don't know if you all were listening to your own early morning show, but they had an interesting observation from people who study chimpanzees. And the business of the chimpanzee learning how to dig termites out of its of their hole with a stick or a piece of grass or something. The comment was that the little girl chimpanzees sit still and watch their moms do this very intently and learn how to do it earlier than the little boy chimpanzees. And I noticed that you were talking about the gender of the child. As the stepmother of three boys and the mother of two girls, I can tell you that my personal experience was that the boys were a lot more rambunctious mm-hmm. and active and running around and all of that. The girls were more willing to sit and watch me do things or their dad in the garden and that kind of thing. So anyway, apparently, maybe this is something that's wired into our genes.
Yeah, you know, you're going to get a lot of argument. Is it nature or nurture? Do we raise our little girls to be little ladies and our boys to be boys?
Of course.
And there's one book I read, Raising Cain, by a couple of psychologists, and I think there's a girl version, too. And I think, you know, we can go on. Yeah, we can argue nature or nurture forever, but I think it doesn't matter. I think most people have had the experience you do. Little boys are different than little girls. Their anatomy is different, but more importantly, their behavior is different. And, you know, in practice, I'd have these ardent whatever who'd say, you know, boys and girls are the same. And then they'd have one of each, and they'd come to the conclusion you came to. Boys and girls are not the same.
Mm-hmm.
They are, but, boy, there's some major differences in
it. Right. Well, I just thought it was interesting that the chimpanzees exhibit some of these same behaviors as the kids.
Yeah. And
right.
we guys, my gender, the stronger sex.
I'll argue that with you.
Yeah, that's probably
I think he was putting
not
that,
exactly
being
right.
Ironic.
Yeah, I can pump more weights than you can, but
well,
in other areas, I am just definitely the weaker sex.
Sure. Okay.
All right. Thank you for the call.
Thank you so much.
We'll do one more here, I think, probably in Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Yeah. What about the consideration of diet for children with this, deficit in terms of attention, with all the sugars and all that kind of thing? I mean, certainly that makes you hyper.
That understudy doesn't seem to have gone very far. It just really doesn't seem to be of any great significance. I think we can talk about caffeine. Okay, let's leave the caffeine out because that is a stimulant. We can talk about the theobromines in chocolate, and you say, okay, leave that out. But let's look at the refined sugars and that sort of stuff, and they can't find any. Studies haven't found anything there that diet has an effect, except maybe with caffeine and theobromine, but probably high amounts of sugar. Probably just doesn't have any.
Well, in terms of the, the white breads, all that other stuff,
yeah.
Certainly has an impact on weight. You know?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
But it doesn't seem to. Yeah, they've intensely looked at that with attention deficit disorder, with behavior and that, and it just really doesn't seem to hold any. It holds weight as far as girth around the middle, but it doesn't seem to hold any weight as far as behavior is concerned.
Okay.
All right. Well, thank you very much for the call. We're almost out of time. Just one other thing I thought I'd mention real quick. Again, this was one of those things I came across when I was looking around for things to talk about. One of the things that we all know is that as adults, we don't get enough sleep. Well, now apparently there's good evidence to show that adolescents, they're pretty much sleep deprived. And now, ladies and gentlemen, a study that says even infants are sleep deprived. And I guess I don't know how you, since probably they spend an awful lot of time sleeping, I don't know how you tell if you have an infant that is sleep deprived.
We still have time to answer this
yeah,
one.
Well,
okay.
You could beg off if you really didn't
want. I don't understand this. I don't understand how anybody said that if you're 13, you're supposed to get exactly 8 hours of sleep, and if you're 12, you're supposed to get 8 hours and 15 minutes. I don't understand. I'd have to do some research, I suppose, but I don't understand how anybody's come up with these exact numbers.
How would you say if you had an infant? I mean, how do you know if baby's getting enough sleep?
I think you let them sleep when they're tired and you wake them up. Yeah, and you don't wake them up. You let them wake up. And I think, I suppose in our society where, okay, I got to get little Johnny or little Sally up because I got to go to work. So I got to wake them up and I got to stuff their breakfast into them. I got to get them dressed and we got to get to the daycare center so I can see where maybe their schedule's been changed. But I think from my experience as a father, and I think my experience in practice, usually when a baby wants to go to sleep, they're going to go to sleep. They'll just going to pass out cold.
Yeah. Okay.
One more comment on sushi. Last month we talked about sushi, and can you feed an infant sushi? And I said yes, but I neglected one thing. I forgot about them. Yeah, at that time I sort of hit the target, but was off the bullseye. There is, fish are contaminated with mercury. So especially the carnivorous fish that eat other fish. Mm-hmm. So I suppose sushi, you need to, I guess I will have to put a question mark on how safe is sushi because we don't know how much mercury is in the particular fish that went into that sushi.
Okay. Well, for this time around, we'll say thank you very much.
You're welcome.
For being here, Dr. Robert Bocek. He's a pediatrician. He's on the program monthly, always on Thursday. We talk about children's health.